look at them to do that. When the new school year started in September, Oswald was still going to be in Russia, although he had already started what would be a lengthy paperwork battle to get back to America with his wife and daughter, June, with whom Marina would be pregnant any day now. It was a battle Oswald would eventually win, playing one superpower bureaucracy off against the other with instinctive, if rudimentary, cleverness. But they wouldn't step off the SS Mazdam and onto American soil until the middle of the next year. And as for Texas... Memes, the school year usually ends the first week in June, doesn't it? Always. The kids who need summer jobs have to nail them down. As for Texas, the Oswalds were going to arrive on the 14th of June, 1962. And any teaching contract I signed would be probationary, right, as in 1 year? With an option to renew if all parties are satisfied, yes. Then you've got yourself a probationary English teacher. She laughed, clapped her hands, got to her feet, and held her arms out. Marvelous! Huggies for Miss Mimi! I hugged her, then released her quickly when I heard her gasp. What the hell is wrong with you, ma'am? She went back to the couch, picked up her iced coffee, and sipped. Let me give you two pieces of advice, George. The first is never call a Texas woman ma'am if you come from the northern climes. It sounds sarcastic. The second is never ask any woman what the hell is wrong with her. Try something slightly more delicate, like, are you feeling quite all right? Are you? Why wouldn't I? I'm getting married. At first, I couldn't match this particular zig with a corresponding zag, except the grave look in her eyes suggested she wasn't zigging at all. She was circling something. Probably not a nice something, either. Say, congratulations, Miss Mimi. Congratulations, Miss Mimi. Deke first popped the question almost a year ago. I put him off, saying it was too soon after his wife died and it would cause talk. As time passes, that has become less effective as an argument. I doubt if there would have been all that much talk anyway, given our ages. People in small towns realize that folks like Deke and me can't afford the luxury of decorum quite so much once we reach a certain, shall we say, plateau of maturity. Truth is, I like things fine just the way they were. The old fellow loves me quite a lot more than I love him, but I like him plenty. And at the risk of embarrassing you, even ladies who've reached a certain plateau of maturity aren't adverse to a nice boink on a Saturday night. Am I embarrassing you? No, I said. Actually, you're delighting me. The dry smile. Lovely. Because when I swing my feet out of bed in the morning, my first thought as they hit the floor is, might there be a way I can delight George Amberson today? And if so, how shall I go about it? Don't exceed your brief, Ms. Mimi. Spoken like a man. She sipped her iced coffee. I had two objectives when I came here today. I've accomplished the first. Now I'll move on to the second so you can get on with your day. Deke and I are going to be married on July 21st, which is a Friday. The ceremony will be a small, private affair in his home, just us, the preacher, and a few family members. His parents, they're quite vigorous for dinosaurs, are coming from Alabama, and my sister from San Diego. The reception will be a lawn party at my house the following day, 2 p.m. until drunk o'clock. We're inviting almost everyone in town. There's going to be a piñata and lemonade for the little kiddies, barbecue and kegs of beer for the big kiddies, and even a band from San Antone. Unlike most bands from San Antone, I believe they are able to play Louie Louie as well as La Paloma. If you don't favor us with your presence, you'll be bereft. Indeed I will. Will you save the date? Absolutely. Good. Deke and I'll be leaving for Mexico on Sunday, by which time his hangover will have dissipated. We're a little old for a honeymoon, but there are certain resources available south of the border that are not available in the six-gun state. Certain experimental treatments, I doubt if they work, but Deke is hopeful. And hell, it's worth a try. Life, she gave a rueful sigh. Life is too sweet to give up without a fight, don't you think? Yes, I said. Yes. So, one holds on. She looked at me closely. Are you going to cry, George? No. Good, because that would embarrass me. I might even cry myself, and I don't do it well. No one would ever write a poem about my tears. I croak. How bad is it, may I ask? Quite bad, she said it offhandedly. I might have 8 months, possibly a year, assuming the herbal treatments or peach pits or whatever down Mexico way don't affect a magical cure, that is. I'm very sorry to hear it. Thank you, George, expressed to a nicety. Any more would be sloppy. I smiled. I have another reason for inviting you to our reception, although it goes without saying that your charming company and sparkling repartee would be enough. Phil Bateman isn't the only one who's retiring. Mimi, don't do that. Take a leave of absence if you have to, but... She shook her head decisively. Sick or well, 40 years is enough. It's time for younger hands, younger eyes, and a younger mind. On my recommendation, Deke has hired a well-qualified young lady from Georgia. Her name is Sadie Clayton. She'll be at the reception. She'll know absolutely no one, and I expect you to be especially nice to her. Mrs. Clayton? I wouldn't quite say that. Mimi looked at me guilelessly. I believe she intends to reclaim her maiden name at some point in the near future, following certain legal formalities. Mimi, are you matchmaking? Not at all, she said, then snickered. Hardly at all, although you will be the only teacher on the English faculty who's currently unattached, and that makes you a natural to act as her mentor. I thought that a gigantic leap into illogic, especially for such an ordered mind. But I accompanied her to the door without saying so. What I said was, if it's as serious as you say, you should be seeking treatment now, and not from some quack doctor in Juarez either. You should be at the Cleveland Clinic. I didn't know if the Cleveland Clinic even existed yet, but just then I didn't care. I think not. Given the choice between dying in a hospital room somewhere, stuck full of tubes and wires, and dying in a seaside Mexican hacienda? That is, as you like to say, a no-brainer. And there's something else as well. She looked at me unflinchingly. The pain isn't too bad yet, but I'm told it will be. In Mexico, they're far less apt to strike moral poses about large doses of morphine, or Nembutal if it comes to that. Trust me, I know what I'm doing. Based on what had happened to Al Templeton, I guess that was true. I put my arms around her, this time hugging very gently. I kissed one leathery cheek. She bore it with a smile, then slipped away. Her eyes searched my face. I'd like to know your story, my friend. I shrugged. I'm an open book, Miss Mimi. She laughed. What a crock of shit. You say you're from Wisconsin, but you showed up in Jody with a New England drawl in your mouth and Florida plates on your auto. You say you're commuting to Dallas for research purposes, and your manuscript purports to be about Dallas, but the people in it speak like New Englanders. In fact, there are a couple of places where characters actually say, "Ayah." You might want to change those. And I thought my rewrite had been so clever. Actually, Mimi, New Englanders say Aya, not Aya. Noted. She continued to search my face. It was a struggle not to drop my eyes, but I managed. Sometimes I've actually caught myself wondering if you might not be a space alien, like Michael Rennie in The Day the Earth Stood Still, here to analyze the natives and report back to Alpha Centauri on whether there's still hope for us as a species, or if we should be exploded by plasma rays before we can spread our germs to the rest of the galaxy. That's very fanciful, I said, smiling. Good. I'd hate to think our whole planet was being judged by Texas. If Jody were used as a sample, I'm sure Earth would get a passing grade. You like it here, don't you? Yes. Is George Amberson your real name? No. I changed it for reasons that are important to me but wouldn't be to anyone else. I'd prefer you kept that to yourself, for obvious reasons. She nodded. I can do that. I'll see you around, George. The diner, the library, and at the party, of course. You'll be nice to Sadie Clayton, won't you? Nice as pie, I said. That made her laugh. When she was gone, I sat in my living room for a long time, not reading, not watching TV, and working on either of my manuscripts was the farthest thing from my mind. I thought about the job I'd just agreed to, a year of teaching full-time English at Denholm Consolidated High School, home of the Lions. I decided I had no regrets. I could roar at halftime with the best of them. Well, I did have one regret, but it wasn't for me. When I thought about Mimi and her current situation, I had regrets aplenty. On the subject of love at first sight, I'm with the Beatles. I believe that it happens all the time. But it didn't happen that way for me and Sadie, although I held her the first time I met her, and with my right hand cupping her left breast. So I guess I'm also with Mickey and Sylvia, who said love is strange. South Central Texas can be savagely hot in mid-July, but the Saturday of the post-wedding party was damn near perfect. With temperatures in the upper 70s and lots of fat white clouds hustling across a sky the color of faded overalls. Long shutters of sun and shadow slipped down Mimi's backyard, which was on a mild slope ending at a muddy trickle of water she called Nameless Creek. There were streamers of yellow and silver, Denholm High colors, strung from the trees, and there was indeed a piñata hung temptingly low from the jutting branch of a sugar pine. No child passed near it without giving it a longing glance. After dinner, the kids will get sticks and beat away on it, someone said from just behind my left shoulder. Candy and toys for all de niños. I turned and beheld Mike Coslaw, resplendent and a little hallucinatory, in tight black jeans and a white open-throated shirt. A sombrero on a tug-string hung down on his back, and he wore a multicolored sash around his waist. I saw a number of other football players, including Jim Ledoux, dressed in the same semi-ridiculous manner, circulating with trays. Mike held his out with a slightly crooked smile.
Can it be, Señor Amberson?
I took a baby shrimp on a toothpick and dipped it in the sauce. Nice get-up. Kind of a Speedy Gonzales thing. Don't start. If you want to see a real get-up, check Vince Knowles. He pointed beyond the net to where a group of teachers was playing a clumsy but enthusiastic game of volleyball. I beheld Vince dressed up in tails and a top hat. He was surrounded by fascinated children who were watching him pull scarves out of thin air. It worked well, if you were still young enough to miss the one poking out of his sleeve. His shoe-polished mustache gleamed in the sun.
On the whole, I prefer the Cisco Kid look, Mike said.
I'm sure you all make terrific waiters, but who in God's name persuaded you to dress up? And does Coach know?
He ought to. He's here.
Oh, I haven't seen him.
He's over by the barbecue pit getting hammered with the Boosters Club.
As for the outfit, Miss Mimi can be pretty persuasive. I thought of the contract I'd signed.
I know.
Mike lowered his voice.
We all know she's sick.
Besides, I think of this as acting. He struck a bullfighter pose, not easy when you're carrying a tray of canapes.
Arriba!
Not bad, but...
I know. I'm not really inside the part yet. Gotta submerge myself, right?
And it works for Brando.
How are you guys gonna be this fall, Mike?
Senior year? Jim in the pocket, me, Hank Alvarez, Chip Wiggins, and Carl Crockett on the line, we're going to state. And that gold ball's going into the trophy case. I like your attitude. Are you going to do a play this fall, Mr. Amberson? That's the plan. Good. Great. Save me a part. But with football, it'll have to be a small one. Check out the band. They're not bad. The band was a lot better than not bad. The logo on the snare drum proclaimed them the Knights. The teenage lead singer counted off, and the band launched into a hot version of Ooh My Head, the old Ritchie Valens song, and not really so old in the summer of 61, although Valens had been dead for almost 2 years. I got my beer in a paper cup and walked closer to the bandstand. The kid's voice was familiar. So was the keyboard, which sounded like it desperately wanted to be an accordion. And suddenly it clicked. The kid was Doug Somm, and not so many years from now he would have hits of his own. She's About a Mover, for one. Mendocino, for another. That would be during the British invasion, so the band, which basically played Tejano rock, would take a pseudo-British name, the Sir Douglas Quintet. George, come here and meet someone, would you? I turned. Mimi was coming down the slope of the lawn with a woman in tow. My first impression of Sadie? Everyone's first impression, I have no doubt, was her height. She was wearing flats, as were most of the women here, knowing that they'd be spending the afternoon and evening traipsing around outside. But this was a woman who had probably last worn heels to her own wedding, and even for that occasion she might have picked a dress that would hide just one more pair of low or no heels, chosen so she wouldn't tower comically over the groom as they stood at the altar. She was 6 feet at least, maybe a little more. I still had her by at least 3 inches, but other than Coach Borman and Greg Underwood of the history department, I was probably the only man at the party who did. And Greg was a beanpole. Sadie had, in the argot of the day, a really good build. She knew it and was self-conscious about it rather than proud. I could tell that from the way she walked. I know I'm a little too big to be considered normal, that walk said. The set of her shoulders said more. It's not my fault, I just growed that way, like Topsy. She was wearing a sleeveless dress printed over with roses. Her arms were tanned. She had dashed on a little pink lipstick, but no other makeup. Not love at first sight, I'm pretty sure of it, but I remember that first sight with surprising clarity. If I told you I remember with similar clarity the first time I saw the former Christy Epping, I'd be lying. Of course, it was at a dance club, and we were both toasted, so maybe I get a pass on that. Sadie was good-looking in an artless, what-you-see-is-what-you-get American girl way. She was something else as well. On the day of the party, I thought that something else was plain old big-person clumsiness. Later, I found out she wasn't clumsy at all, was in fact the farthest thing from it. Mimi looked good, or at least no worse than she had on the day she'd come to my house and convinced me to teach full-time, but she was wearing makeup, which was unusual. It didn't quite conceal the hollows under her eyes, probably caused by a combination of sleeplessness and pain, or the new lines at the corners of her mouth. But she was smiling, and why not? She had married her fella, she'd thrown a party that was obviously a roaring success, and she had brought a pretty girl in a pretty summer dress to meet the school's only eligible English teacher. "Hey, Mimi," I said, starting up the mild slope toward her, weaving my way around the card tables borrowed from the Amvets Hall, where people would later sit to eat barbecue and watch the sunset. "Congratulations! I guess now I'll have to get used to calling you Miss Simmons?" She smiled her dry smile. "Please stick to Mimi. It's what I'm used to. I have a new faculty member I want you to meet. This is..." Someone had neglected to push one of the folding chairs all the way back in, and the big blonde girl, already holding her hand out to me and composing her "how nice to meet you" smile, tripped over it and went spilling forward. The chair came with her, tipping up, and I saw the potential for a nasty accident if one of the legs speared her in the stomach. I dropped my cup of beer in the grass, took a giant step forward, and grabbed her as she fell. My left arm went around her waist. My right hand landed higher, grabbing something warm and round and slightly yielding. Between my hand and her breast, the cotton of her dress slipped over the smooth nylon or silk of whatever she was wearing beneath. It was an intimate introduction, but we had the banging angles of the chair for a chaperone, and although I staggered a little against the momentum of her 150 or so pounds, I kept my feet, and she kept hers. I took my hand away from the part of her that is rarely grasped when strangers are introduced, and said, "Hello, I'm Jake. I came within a hair of giving my 21st century name, but caught it at the very last moment. "I'm George. How nice to make your acquaintance." She was blushing to the roots of her hair. I probably was too, but she had the good grace to laugh. "Nice to make yours. I think you just saved me from a very nasty accident." Probably I had, because that was it, you see. Sadie wasn't clumsy. She was accident-prone. It was amusing until you realized what it really was, a kind of haunting. She was the girl, she told me later, who got the hem of her dress caught in a car door when she and her date arrived at the senior prom and managed to tear her skirt right off as they headed for the gym. She was the woman around whom water fountains malfunctioned, giving her a faceful. The woman who was apt to set an entire book of matches on fire when she lit a cigarette, burning her fingers or singeing her hair. The woman whose bra strap broke during parents' night, or who discovered huge runs in her stockings before school assemblies at which she was scheduled to speak. She was careful to mind her head going through doors, as all sensible tall folks learned to be. But people had a tendency to open them incautiously in her face just as she was approaching them. She'd been stuck in elevators on 3 occasions, once for 2 hours. And the year before, in a Savannah department store, the recently installed escalator had gobbled one of her shoes. Of course, I knew none of this then. All I knew on that July afternoon was that a good-looking woman with blonde hair and blue eyes had fallen into my arms. "I see you and Miss Dunhill are already getting along famously," Mimi said. "I'll leave you to get to know one another." So, I thought, the change from Mrs. Clayton to Miss Dunhill had already been effected, legal formalities or not. Meanwhile, the chair was stuck into the sod by one leg. When Sadie tried to tug it free, it wouldn't come at first. When it did, the back of the chair ran nimbly up her thigh, hiking her skirt and revealing one stocking top all the way to the garter, which was as pink as the roses on her dress. She gave a little cry of exasperation. Her blush darkened to an alarming shade of fire brick. I took the chair and set it firmly aside. "Miss Dunhill, Sadie, if I ever saw a woman who could use a cold beer, that woman is you. Come with me." "Thank you," she said. "I'm so sorry. My mother told me never to throw myself at men, but I've never learned." As I led her toward the line of kegs, pointing out various faculty members along the way and taking her arm to steer her around a volleyball player who looked like he was going to collide with her as he backpedaled to return a high lob, I felt sure of one thing. We could be colleagues, and we could be friends, maybe good friends, but we'd never be any more than that, no matter what Mimi might hope for. In a comedy starring Rock Hudson and Doris Day, our introduction would have undoubtedly qualified as meet cute. But in real life, in front of an audience that was still grinning, it was just awkward and embarrassing. Yes, she was pretty. Yes, it was very nice to be walking with such a tall girl and still be taller. And sure, I had enjoyed the yielding firmness of that breast, cupped inside its thin double layer of proper cotton and sexy nylon. But unless you're 15, an accidental grope at a lawn party does not qualify as love at first sight. I got the newly minted or re-minted Miss Dunhill a beer, and we stood conversing near the makeshift bar for the requisite amount of time. We laughed when the dove Vince Knowles had rented for the occasion poked its head out of his top hat and pecked his finger. I pointed out more Denholm educators, many already leaving Sobriety City on the Alcohol Express. She said she would never get to know them all, and I assured her she would. I asked her to call on me if she needed help with anything. The requisite number of minutes, the expected conversational gambits. Then she thanked me again for saving her from a nasty fall, and went to see if she could help gather the kids into the pinata-bashing mob they would soon become. I watched her go, not in love, but a little in lust. I'll admit I mused briefly on the stocking top and the pink garter. My thoughts returned to her that night as I got ready for bed. She filled a large amount of space in a very nice way, and my eye hadn't been the only one following the pleasant sway of her progress in the print dress, but really, that was it. What more could there be? I'd read a book called A Reliable Wife not too long before leaving on the world's strangest trip, and as I climbed into bed, a line from the novel crossed my mind. He had lost the habit of romance. That's me, I thought as I turned out the light. Totally out of the habit. And then as the crickets sang me to sleep, but it wasn't just the breast that was nice, it was the weight of her. The weight of her in my arms. As it turned out, I hadn't lost the habit of romance at all. August and Jody was an oven, with temperatures at least in the 90s every day and often breaking 100. The air conditioning in my rented house on Mesa Lane was good, but not good enough to withstand that sort of sustained assault. Sometimes, if there was a cooling shower, the nights were a little better, but not by much. I was at my desk on the morning of August 27th, working away at the murder place in a pair of basketball shorts and nothing else, when the doorbell rang. I frowned. It was Sunday. I'd heard the sound of competing church bells not too long previous, and most of the people I knew attended one of the town's four or five places of worship. I pulled on a T-shirt and went to the door. Coach Borman was standing there with Ellen Dougherty, the former head of the Home Ec Department and DCHS's acting principal for the coming year. To no one's surprise, Deke had tendered his resignation on the same day Mimi tendered hers. Coach was stuffed into a dark blue suit and a loud tie that looked like it was strangling his plug of a neck. Ellen was wearing a prim gray outfit, relieved by a spray of lace at her throat. They looked solemn. My first thought, as persuasive as it was wild, they know. Somehow they know who I am and where I came from. They're here to tell me. Coach Borman's lips were trembling, and although Ellen didn't sob, tears filled her eyes. Then I knew. Is it Mimi? Coach nodded.
Deke called me. I got Ellie. I usually take her to church, and we're letting people know. The one she liked the best.
I'm sorry to hear, I said. How's Deke?
He seems to be bearing up, Ellen said, then glanced at Coach with some asperity. According to him, at least.
Yeah, he's okay, Coach said. Broken up, of course.
Sure he is.
He's going to have her cremated.
Ellen's lips thinned in disapproval.
Said it was what she wanted.
I thought about it.
We should have some sort of special assembly once school's back in. Can we do that?
People can speak. Maybe we could put together a slideshow. People must have lots of pictures of her.
That's a wonderful idea, Ellen said. Could you organize it, George?
I'd be happy to try.
Get Miss Dunhill to help you.
And before the suspicion of more matchmaking could even begin to cross my mind, she added,
I think it will help the boys and girls who loved memes to know her hand-picked replacement helped plan the memorial assembly. It will help Sadie, too.
Of course it would. As a newcomer, she could use a little banked goodwill to start the year with.
Okay, I'll talk to her.
Thank you both. Are you going to be okay?
Sure,
Coach said stoutly, but his lips were still trembling. I liked him for that. They went slowly down to his car, which was parked at the curb.
Coach had his hand on Ellen's elbow. I liked him for that, too. I closed the door, sat down on the bench in the little dab of front hall, and thought about Mimi saying she would be bereft if I didn't take over the junior-senior play, and if I didn't sign on to teach full-time for at least a year. Also, if I didn't come to her wedding party. Mimi, who thought Catcher in the Rye belonged in the school library, and who wasn't averse to a nice boink on Saturday night. She was one of those faculty members the kids remember long after graduation and sometimes come back to visit when they're no longer kids. The kind who sometimes shows up in a troubled student's life at a critical moment and makes a critical difference. Who can find a virtuous woman? The proverb asks. For her price is above rubies. She seeketh wool and flax and worketh willingly with her hands. She is like the merchant's ships that bringeth food from afar. There are more clothes than the ones you put on your body. Every teacher knows that. And food isn't just what you put in your mouth. Miss Mimi had fed and clothed many, including me. I sat there on a bench I'd bought at a Fort Worth flea market with my head lowered and my face in my hands. I thought about her, and I was very sad. But my eyes remained dry. I've never been what you'd call a crying man. Sadie immediately agreed to help me put together a memorial assembly. We worked on it for the last 2 weeks of that hot August, driving around town to line up speakers. I tapped Mike Coslaw to read Proverbs 31, which describes the virtuous woman. And Al Stevens volunteered to tell the story, which I'd never heard from Mimi herself, about how she had named the prong burger, his specialité de la maison. We also collected over 200 photographs. My favorite showed Mimi and Deke doing the twist at a school dance. She looked like she was having fun. He looked like a man with a fair-sized stick up his ass. We called the photos in the school library, where the nameplate on the desk now read Miss Dunhill instead of Ms. Mimi. During that time, Sadie and I never kissed, never held hands, never even looked into each other's eyes for longer than a passing glance. She didn't talk about her busted marriage or her reasons for coming to Texas from Georgia. I didn't talk about my novel or tell her about my largely made-up past. We talked about books. We talked about Kennedy, whose foreign policy she considered jingoistic. We discussed the nascent civil rights movement. I told her about the board across the creek at the bottom of the path behind the Humble Oil Station in North Carolina. She said she'd seen similar toilet facilities for colored people in Georgia, but believed their days were numbered. She thought school integration would come, but probably not until the mid-70s. I told her I thought it would be sooner, driven by the new president and his attorney general kid brother. She snorted, "You have more respect for that grinning Irishman than I do. Tell me, does he ever get his hair cut?" We didn't become lovers, but we became friends. Sometimes she tripped over things, including her own feet, which were large, and on two occasions I steadied her. But there were no catches as memorable as the first one. Sometimes she'd declare she just had to have a cigarette, and I'd accompany her out to the student smoking area behind the metal shop. "I'll be sorry not to be able to come out here and sprawl on the bench in my old blue jeans," she said one day. This was less than a week before school was scheduled to start. "There's always such a fug in teachers' rooms." Someday that'll all change. Smoking will be banned on school grounds for teachers as well as students. She smiled. It was a good one because her lips were rich and full, and the jeans, I must say, looked good on her. She had long, long legs, not to mention just enough junk in her trunk. "A cigarette-free society? Negro children and white children studying side by side in perfect harmony? No wonder you're writing a novel. You've got one hell of an imagination. What else do you see in your crystal ball, George? Rockets to the moon?" Sure, but it'll probably take a little longer than integration.
Who told you I was writing a novel?
Ms. Mamie, she said, and butted her cigarette in one of the half a dozen sand urn ashtrays. She said it was good.
And speaking of Ms. Mamie, I suppose we ought to get back to work.
I think we're almost there with the photographs, don't you?
Yes.
And are you sure playing that West Side Story song over the slideshow isn't going to be too corny?
I thought Somewhere was cornier than Iowa and Nebraska put together, but according to Ellen Dougherty, it had been Mimi's favorite song.
I told Sadie this, and she laughed doubtfully.
I didn't know her all that well, but it sure doesn't seem like her.
Maybe it's Ellie's favorite song.
Now that I think about it, that seems all too likely.
Listen, Sadie, do you want to go to the football game with me on Friday? Kind of show the kids that you're here before school starts on Monday?
I'd love to.
Then she paused, looking a little uncomfortable. As long as you don't, you know, get any ideas. I'm not ready to date just yet. Maybe not for a long time.
Neither am I.
She was probably thinking about her ex. But I was thinking about Lee Oswald. Soon he'd have his American passport back. Then it would only be a matter of wrangling a Soviet exit visa for his wife.
But friends sometimes go to the game together.
That's right, they do. And I like going places with you, George.
Because I'm taller.
She punched my arm playfully, a big sister kind of punch.
That's right, partner.
You're the kind of man I can look up to.
At the game, practically everybody looked up to us, and with faint awe, as though we were representatives of a slightly different race of humans. I thought it was kind of nice. And for once, Sadie didn't have to slouch to fit in. She wore a lion pride sweater and her faded jeans. With her blonde hair pulled back in a ponytail, she looked like a high school senior herself, a tall one, probably the center on the girls' basketball team. We sat in faculty row and cheered as Jim Ledoux riddled the Arnett Bears defense with half a dozen short passes and then a 60-yard bomb that brought the crowd to its feet. At halftime, the score was Denholm 31, Arnett 6. As the players ran off the field and the Denholm band marched onto it with their tubas and trombones wagging, I asked Sadie if she wanted a hot dog and a Coke.
You bet I do, but right now the line will be all the way out to the parking lot. Wait until there's a timeout in the third quarter or something.
We have to roar like lions and do the gym cheer.
I think you can manage those things on your own. She smiled at me and gripped my arm.
No, I need you to help me. I'm new here. Remember?
At her touch, I felt a warm little shiver I did not associate with friendship. And why not? Her cheeks were flushed, her eyes were sparkling. Under the lights and the greeny-blue sky of a deepening Texas dusk, she was way beyond pretty. Things between us might have progressed faster than they did, except for what happened during that halftime.
The band marched around, the way high school bands do, in step but not completely in tune, blaring a medley you couldn't quite figure out. When they finished, the cheerleaders trotted to the 50-yard line, dropped their pom-poms in front of their feet, and put their hands on their hips.
"Give us an L!"
We gave them what they required, and when further importuned, we obliged with an I, an O, an N, and an S.
"What's that spell?"
"Lions!" Everybody on the home bleachers up and clapping.
"Who's gonna win?"
"Lions!" Given the halftime score, there wasn't much doubt about it.
"Then let us hear you roar!"
We roared in the traditional manner, turning first to the left and then to the right. Sadie gave it her all, cupping her hands around her mouth, her ponytail flying from one shoulder to the other. What came next was the gym cheer. In the previous 3 years, yes, our Mr. Ledoux had started at QB even as a freshman. This had been pretty simple. The cheerleaders would yell something like,
Let us hear your lion pride. Name the man who leads our side. And the hometown crowd would bellow, Jim! 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 After that, the cheerleaders would do a few more cartwheels and then run off the field so the other team's band could march out and tootle a tune or two. But this year, possibly in honor of Jim's valedictory season, the chant had changed. Each time the crowd yelled, Jim! The cheerleaders responded with the first syllable of his last name, drawing it out like a teasing musical note. It was new, but it wasn't complicated, and the crowd caught on in a hurry. Sadie was doing the chant with the best of them until she realized I wasn't. I was just standing there with my mouth open. George, are you okay? I couldn't answer. In fact, I barely heard her, because most of me was back in Lisbon Falls. I had just come through the rabbit hole. I had just walked along the side of the drying shed and ducked under the chain. I had been prepared to meet the yellow card man, but not to be attacked by him, which I was. Only he was no longer the yellow card man, now he was the orange card man.
You're not supposed to be here, he had said. Who are you? What are you doing here?
And when I'd started to ask him if he'd tried AA for his drinking problem, he'd said, George? Now she sounded worried as well as concerned. What is it? What's wrong? The fans had totally gotten into the call and response thing. The cheerleaders shouted, Jim! And the bleacher creatures shouted back, La!
Fuck off, Jimla!
That was what the yellow card man, who'd become the orange card man, although not yet the dead by his own hand black card man, had snarled at me. And that was what I was hearing now, tossed back and forth like a medicine ball between the cheerleaders and the 2,500 fans watching them.
Jimla! Jimla! Jimla!
Sadie grabbed my arm and shook me. Talk to me, mister. Talk to me, because I'm getting scared. I turned to her and managed a smile. It did not come easy, believe me. Just crashing for sugar, I guess. I'm going to grab those Cokes. You aren't going to faint, are you? I can walk you to the aid station if I'm fine, I said, and then without thinking about what I was doing, I kissed the tip of her nose. Some kid shouted, Way to go, Mr. A! Rather than looking irritated, she wriggled her nose like a rabbit, then smiled, Get out of here, then, before you damage my reputation, and bring me a chili dog. Lots of cheese. Yes, ma'am. The past harmonizes with itself, that much I already understood. But what song was this? I didn't know, and it worried me plenty. In the concrete runway leading to the refreshment stand, the chant was magnified, making me want to put my hands over my ears to block it out.
Jimla! Jimla! Jimla!
Part 4. Sadie and the General. Chapter 14. The Memorial Assembly was held at the end of the new school year's first day, and if one can measure success by damp hankies, the show Sadie and I put together was boffo. I'm sure it was cathartic for the kids, and I think Miss Mimi herself would have enjoyed it. Sarcastic people tend to be marshmallows underneath the armor, she once told me. I'm no different. The teachers held it together through most of the eulogies. It was Mike who started to get to them with his calm, heartfelt recitation from Proverbs 31. Then, during the slideshow with the accompanying schmaltz from West Side Story, the faculty lost it too. I found Coach Borman particularly entertaining, with tears streaming down his red cheeks and large quacking sobs emerging from his massive chest. Denholm's football guru reminded me of everybody's second favorite cartoon duck, Baby Huey. I whispered this observation to Sadie as we stood beside the big screen with its marching images of Ms. Mimi.
She was crying too, but had to step off the stage and into the wings as laughter first fought with and then overcame her tears. Safely back in the shadows, she looked at me reproachfully and then gave me the finger. I decided I deserved it. I wondered if Ms. Mimi would still think Sadie and I were getting along famously. I thought she probably would. I picked 12 angry men for the fall play, accidentally on purpose neglecting to inform the Samuel French Company that I intended to retitle our version The Jury so I could cast some girls. I would hold tryouts in late October and start rehearsals on November 13th, after the Lions' last regular season football game. I had my eye on Vince Knowles for juror number 8, the holdout who'd been played by Henry Fonda in the movie, and Mike Coslaw for what I considered the best part in the show, bullying abrasive juror number 3. But I had begun to focus on a more important show, one that made the Frank Dunning affair look like a paltry vaudeville skit by comparison. Call this one Jake and Lee in Dallas. If things went well, it would be a tragedy in one act. I had to be ready to go on stage when the time came, and that meant starting early. On the 6th of October, the Denholm Lions won their 5th football game on their way to an undefeated season that would be dedicated to Vince Knowles, the boy who had played George in Of Mice and Men, and who would never get a chance to act in the George Amberson version of 12 Angry Men. But more of that later. It was the start of a 3-day weekend because the Monday following was Columbus Day. I drove to Dallas on the holiday. Most businesses were open, and my first stop was one of the pawn shops on Greenville Avenue. I told the little man behind the counter that I wanted to buy the cheapest wedding ring he had in stock. I walked out with an 8-buck band of gold, at least it looked like gold, on the 3rd finger of my left hand. Then I drove downtown to a place on Lower Main Street I'd bird-dogged in the Dallas Yellow Pages, Silent Mike's Satellite Electronics. There I was greeted by a trim little man who wore horn-rimmed glasses and a weirdly futuristic button on his vest. "Trust nobody," it said. "Are you Silent Mike?" I asked.
"Yep."
"And are you truly silent?" He smiled.
"Depends on who's listening."
"Let's assume nobody," I said, and told him what I wanted. It turned out I could have saved my 8 bucks, because he had no interest at all in my supposedly cheating wife. It was the equipment I wanted to buy that interested the proprietor of Satellite Electronics. On that subject, he was loquacious, Mike.
"Mister, they may have gear like that on whatever planet you come from, but we sure don't have it here."
That stirred a memory of Ms. Mimi comparing me to the alien visitor in The Day the Earth Stood Still. "I don't know what you mean."
"You want a small wireless listening device? Fine, I got a bunch in that glass case right over there to your left. They're called transistor radios. I stock both Motorola and GE, but the Japanese make the best ones."
He stuck out his lower lip and blew a lock of hair off his forehead.
"Ain't that a kick in the behind? We beat 'em 15 years ago by bombing 2 of their cities to radioactive dust, but do they die? No. They hide in their holes until the dust settles, then come crawling back out armed with circuit boards and soldering irons instead of Nambu machine guns. By 1985, they'll own the world. The part of it I live in, anyway."
"So you can't help me?"
"What are you kidding? Sure I can. Silent Mike McKeekern's always happy to help fill a customer's electronic needs. But it'll cost."
"I'd be willing to pay quite a bit. It could save me even more when I get that cheating bitch into divorce court."
"Uh-huh. Wait here a minute while I get something out of the back. And turn that sign in the door over to closed, would you? I'm going to show you something that's probably not, well, maybe it is legal, but who knows? Is Silent Mike McKeekern an attorney?"
"I'm guessing not." My guide to 60s-era electronica reappeared with a weird-looking gadget in one hand and a small cardboard box in the other. The printing on the box was in Japanese. The gadget looked like a dildo for pixie chicks, mounted on a black plastic disc. The disc was 3 inches thick and about the diameter of a quarter, with a spray of wires coming out of it. He put it on the counter.
"This is an Echo, manufactured right here in town, son. If anyone can beat the Sons of Nippon at their own game, it's us. Electronics is going to replace banking in Dallas by 1970. Mark my words."
He crossed himself, pointed skyward, and added, "God bless Texas." I picked the gadget up. What exactly is an Echo when it's at home with its feet up on the hassock?
"The closest thing to the kind of bug you described to me that you're going to get. It's small because it doesn't have any vacuum tubes and doesn't run on batteries. It runs on ordinary AC house current."
"You plug it into the wall?"
"Sure. Why not? Your wife and her boyfriend can look at it and say, 'How nice. Someone bugged the place while we were out. Let's have a nice noisy shag, then talk over all our private business.'"
He was a geek, all right. Still, patience is a virtue, and I needed what I needed.
"What do you do with it, then?"
He tapped the disc.
"This goes inside the base of a lamp. Not a floor lamp, unless you're interested in recording the mice running around inside the baseboards, you dig? A table lamp, so it's up where people talk."
He brushed the wires. "The red and yellow ones connect to the lamp cord. Lamp cord's plugged into the wall. The bug's dead until someone turns on the lamp. When they do, bingo, you're off to the races."
"This other thing is the mic?"
"Yep. And for American made, it's a good one. Now, you see the other two wires, the blue and green ones?"
"Uh-huh." He opened the cardboard box with the Japanese writing on it and took out a reel-to-reel recorder. It was bigger than a pack of Sadie's Winstons, but not by much.
"Those wires hook up to this. Base unit goes in the lamp. Recorder goes in a bureau drawer, or maybe under your wife's scanties. Or drill a little hole in the wall and put it in the closet."
"The recorder also draws power from the lamp cord."
"Naturally."
"Could I get two of these Echoes?"
"I could get you four if you wanted. Might take a week, though."
"Two will be fine. How much?"
"Stuff like this ain't cheap. A pair'd run you $140, best I can do. And it would have to be a cash deal."
He spoke with a regret that suggested we'd been having a nice little techno dream for ourselves, but now the dream was almost over. "How much more would it cost me to have you do the installation?" I saw his alarm and hastened to dispel it. "I don't mean the actual black bag job, nothing like that. Just to put the bugs in a couple of lamps and hook up the tape recorders. Could you do that?"
"Of course I could, Mr.
Let's say Mr. Doe. John Doe." His eyes sparkled as I imagine E. Howard Hunt's would when he first beheld the challenge that was the Watergate Hotel.
"Good name."
"Thanks, and it would be good to have a couple of options with the wires. Something short, if I can place it close by, something longer if I need to hide it in a closet or on the other side of a wall."
"I can do that, but you don't want more than 10 feet or the sound turns to mud. Also, the more wire you use, the greater the chance that someone will find it."
Even an English teacher could understand that. "How much for the whole deal?"
$180?
He looked ready to haggle, but I didn't have the time or the inclination. I put 520s down on the counter and said, "You get the rest when I pick them up. But first we test them out and make sure they work. Agreed?"
"Yeah, fine."
"One other thing. Get used lamps. Kind of grungy."
"Grungy?"
"Like they were picked up at a yard sale or a flea market for a quarter apiece. After you direct a few plays, counting the ones I'd worked on at LHS, Of Mice and Men had been my fifth, you learn a few things about set decoration. The last thing I wanted was someone stealing a bug-loaded lamp from a semi-furnished apartment." For a moment he looked puzzled, then a complicitous smile dawned on his face.
I get it. Realism.
That's the plan, Stan. I started for the door, then came back, leaned my forearms on the transistor radio display case, and looked into his eyes. I can't swear that he saw the man who had killed Frank Dunning, but I can't say for sure that he didn't either. You're not going to talk about this, are you?
No! Of course not.
He zipped two fingers across his lips. That's the way, I said. When?
Give me a few days.
I'll come back next Monday. What time do you close?
5?
I calculated the distance from Jody to Dallas and said, an extra 20 if you stay open until 7. It's the soonest I can make it. That work for you?
Yeah.
Good. Have everything ready.
I will. Anything else?
Yeah. Why the hell do they call you Silent Mike? I was hoping he'd say because I can keep a secret, but he didn't.
When I was a kid, I thought that Christmas carol was about me. It just kind of stuck.
I didn't ask, but halfway back to my car, it came to me, and I started to laugh. Silent Mike. Holy Mike. Ah, sometimes the world we live in is a truly weird place. When Lee and Marina returned to the United States, they'd live in a sad procession of low-rent apartments, including the one in New Orleans I'd already visited, but based on Al's notes, I thought there were only two I needed to focus on. One was at 214 West Neely Street in Dallas. The other was in Fort Worth, and that was where I went after my visit to Silent Mike's. I had a map of the city, but still had to ask directions 3 times. In the end, it was an elderly black woman clerking at a mom-and-pop who pointed me the right way. When I finally found what I was looking for, I wasn't surprised that it had been hard to locate. The ass end of Mercedes Street was unpaved hardpan, lined with crumbling houses little better than sharecroppers' shacks. It spilled into a huge, mostly empty parking lot where tumbleweeds blew across the crumbling asphalt. Beyond the lot was the back of a cinder block warehouse. Printed on it in whitewashed letters, 10 feet tall, was Property of Montgomery Ward, and Trespassers Will Be Prosecuted, and Police Take Note. The air stank of cracked petroleum from the direction of Odessa Midland, and raw sewage much closer at hand. The sound of rock and roll spilled from open windows. I heard the Duvels, Johnny Burnett, Lee Dorsey, Chubby Checker, and that was in the first 40 yards or so. Women were hanging clothes on rusty whirligigs. They were all wearing smocks that had probably been purchased at Zayre's or Mammoth Mart, and they all appeared to be pregnant. A filthy little boy and an equally filthy little girl stood on a cracked clay driveway and watched me go by. They were holding hands and looked too much alike not to be twins. The boy, naked except for a single sock, was holding a cap pistol. The girl was wearing a saggy diaper below a Mickey Mouse Club t-shirt. She was clutching a plastic baby doll, as filthy as she was. 2 bare-chested men were throwing a football back and forth between their respective yards, both of them with cigarettes hanging from the corners of their mouths. Beyond them, a rooster and 2 bedraggled chickens pecked in the dust near a scrawny dog that was either sleeping or dead. I pulled up in front of 2703, the place to which Lee would bring his wife and daughter when he could no longer stand Marguerite Oswald's pernicious brand of smother love. 2 concrete strips led up to a bald patch of oil-stained ground where there would have been a garage in a better part of town. The wasteland of crabgrass that passed for a lawn was littered with cheap plastic toys. A little girl in ragged pink shorts was kicking a soccer ball repeatedly against the side of the house. Each time it hit the wooden siding, she said, "Chumba!" A woman with her hair in large blue rollers and a cigarette plugged in her gob shoved her head at the window and shouted,
"You keep doing that, Rosette. I'm going to come out and beat you snotty."
Then she saw me.
"What you want?" If it's a bill, I can't help you. My husband does all that. He got work today.
It's not a bill, I said. Rosette